Welcome to In Session, where we talk about mental health and navigating resources in our community. Just a reminder, nothing in this podcast is intended to establish a therapist-patient relationship, to replace the services of a trained therapist, doctor, or health professional, or otherwise to substitute for professional mental health, medical advice, diagnose, or treat. Information presented in this podcast represents the opinions of the hosts and guests. The content here should not be taken as medical advice. The content here is for informational purposes only, and listeners should consult their healthcare professionals for individual medical and psychological needs. This podcast will be mentioning difficult topics related to mental health challenges, so please do what you need to do to take care of yourself. If you find yourself experiencing any of the things mentioned, please access local mental health resources or contact the Maine Crisis Hotline at 1-888-568-1112 or the National Suicide and Crisis Lifeline at 988.
I'm Jordan. I'm a clinical mental health counselor in the state of Maine.
I'm Shelby. I'm a clinical mental health counselor also in the state of Maine.
I'm Maisie. I'm a master's level social worker. So on this episode, we are interviewing a professor of mine when I was in grad school for my MSW. He's a psychotherapist, adjunct professor, and school board member, and he is going to speak to us today about toxic stress, how stress manifests in the body, when post-traumatic stress disorder comes into play, and just sort of everything you need to know about stress, and hopefully how to manage it as well.
All things stress.
Yeah. So thank you so much, Lauren, for being here with us today. We can kind of jump right in.
Yeah. Okay. So Lauren,
thank you for having me, by the way. I'm really glad to be here. Thank you.
Thank you.
Lauren, I'm curious, you fill a couple of different roles, psychotherapist, adjunct faculty, member of school board in your community, those sorts of things. How have you seen, especially as we're sort of continuing to navigate this pandemic and things like that, this idea of toxic stress emerging?
All right. So I view everything from a biological and evolutionary perspective, like why do we feel what we feel? And we have to feel life in order to navigate it well. So our feelings, I think they come down, they break down into four families, or joy, fear, anger, and sadness. So there are two kinds of stress that really affect us psychologically. PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, a lot of people know about that, and it is basically from an event, a terrifying event, raped, beat up, house fire, whatever you want, just anything that's terrifying, that's PTSD. It's in the diagnostic manual. We teach about it. We talk about it. But what we don't talk about is toxic stress. And I think that's actually a lot more consequential. It is the number one concern, the number one source of psychological difficulty is the result of toxic stress. So toxic stress is living in constant fear. PTSD is a traumatic event, a big fearful event. That's how you distinguish between them. And a lot of people have experienced both. Mm-hmm. Let's say they grow up in an environment of abuse, sexual, physical, verbal, some combination, and then they're beat up or they're raped. Mm-hmm. That is an incredibly common experience, unfortunately, but it's the combination of two kinds of stress that are similar but distinct. So right now, what I see in terms of toxic stress is fear of abuse, living in abuse, fear of failure, living in failure, or what I call FOMU, fear of measuring up. Mm-hmm. Fear of measuring up has become an extremely challenging experience, especially for adolescents, because when you become 13 years old, and anybody does, it's now time to fit in with your peers. Mm-hmm. And that's been evident for thousands, millions of years. But what happens now with social media, especially, is that you're constantly comparing yourself to others and vice versa. And there's bullying and there's an ad, and the fear of measuring up, measuring up can be just constant, like every day. So I think, like, you know, like if a lot of your audience are college students, there's often this fear of failure in terms of academic. I have got to do well. I have got to get good grades. And then you match that with FOMO, fear of measuring up on social media all the time. That can become toxically stressful. Mm-hmm. Now, importantly, what happens from toxic stress is, first of all, the amygdala in the brain grows bigger and bigger, and the science tells us that clearly. And with an enlarged, hyperactive, overactive amygdala, I call Big Amy, that may you remember, it's called generalized anxiety disorder in the DSM. And if that goes on too long, it's really hard, if not then impossible, to do life. And then generalized anxiety disorder can become panic attacks, which can become panic disorder, and then suicidal ideation. There's just a clear line. Mm-hmm. So the sooner we treat the effect of toxic stress, if it occurs in terms of Big Amy or generalized anxiety disorder, the better someone's going to feel and feel great, and then prevent the rest of it from happening.
Yeah. I like that image of Big Amy.
Yes.
Taking over.
Big Amy, small hippo was the other.
Right. It's eventually with toxic stress or the fear response and the cortisol that happens from it, the amygdala gets bigger, but the hippocampus can shrink. Mm-hmm. So with a Big Amy, it's generalized anxiety. And with a small hippo, it's generalized depression or a type of major depressive disorder.
Okay.
And again, I'm going to come back to, if I haven't said it already, too many lines on the savanna. This is why we have Big Amy and small hippo. There's nothing wrong with us when this happened. Nothing. Right. Nothing wrong with us, and nobody is doomed. We can treat this. So Big Amy happens when we're surrounded. I was just talking about this with a patient like 30 minutes ago. So when we're surrounded by a lion on the savanna, because we came from the African savanna about 80,000 years ago. So all the millions of years of evolution led us and other mammals to have a Big Amy. Like, we're surrounded by lions all the time. We have to be hypervigilant or we die. And so the amygdala grows to be like, I just heard a snap of a twig. It's probably a lion. What do I got to do? Versus if you've never had lions surrounding you for a long time and you hear a snap, you're like, yeah, it's a twig, what do I care? Mm-hmm. So a Big Amy, and for a human being with reflective awareness, it's really, really difficult, but it's why it exists. Mm-hmm. There's nothing wrong with this when it happens, and we're never doomed. It can change back.
Yeah.
I remember when you taught us that in class, it was so wild to hear about the physiological changes that your body goes through as a result of stress. And I think it's almost liberating to know that at a certain point, like, there's something going on a deeper level, and it's not easy as, you know, it's not as easy as just calming down or just like, working through it. Like, it's a physiological change that you have to address.
Yeah. You're not just like making it up. Like, it really is physically, you know, happening.
Oh man. Never making it up. Yeah. Never.
I thought that was so cool when I learned that for the first time. I was like, wow, there's a change happening.
Right.
Yeah.
It's a change that happens to anybody at any age, and for any reason of toxic stress, because it's supposed to change. Mm-hmm. And of course, we can change it back.
Are there any sort of protective factors that can sort of, you know, if you are experiencing too many lions on the savanna, are there any, I guess, factors that come into play or things to sort of mediate that if you've gone through it? I'm jumping the gun a little bit, but just to kind of bring that back down, I guess.
Lots of love. And I mean that on purpose. The human joy response is all about when we are in a liking or loving or caring relationship with others. And it is the most effective things to bring that down. And so, like, if you're living in an environment of fear only, like your family life is fearful all the time, we often hear of kids who make it out of that because they had one caring adult. Mm-hmm. And that's why, because you feel the caring from other people. It bathes your neurological system, and it is definitely a helpful factor, preventive factor to developing a Big Amy. kids without that, quite literally, kids who grow up in constant abuse and neglect are the ones who typically become what we term in the media psychopaths, and it's antisocial personality disorder, where there's nobody for you and you've experienced so much abuse, you're in that zone the rest of your life, right? So that's in the worst case scenario. But you know, I have so many patients who grew up in a very toxic environment, but grandma was awesome. Mm-hmm. I could go to grandma's house and she loved me, and I'd hang out there every day after school, and I'd go home because I had to go to sleep, and it was awful at home. But then my grandma, you know, so it's amazing how at least one caring adult can make a difference, which brings me to my school board life. So Our mission in RSU 13 down here in the Rockland area is threefold: relationships, proficiencies, and pathways. And it's just relationships. We focus on that first because we want to create an environment of caring relationships for all our kids, because it's good for every human being, the three of you and me. And it's really good for kids who are experiencing a lot of toxic stress.
Yeah. I mean, I know, Maisie, you've spent a good part of your career already working with kids, even before your graduate training. I have a wealth of experience in that same realm. And mm-hmm. Shelby, I think you've had some of that experience too. And
yep.
I think we can all sort of resonate with what you're saying in terms of seeing the power of a caring community or a caring individual mm-hmm. on the impact of a child. And then as you follow that child throughout their life, watching them be able to develop from yep. pretty traumatic experiences because of those.
Yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And you all in your professional roles, I mean, you are first and foremost caring. And yep. if we in our professional roles as mental health practitioners, if we're not caring, A, people won't come back, and B, they're not going to get better. Right. So we have technique, but it's really secondary, even tertiary, to caring, to listening and validating. I don't know if Maisie, you remember the love model. Listen, understand, and validate.
Mm-hmm.
I think probably last year, or maybe last summer, I really focused on it a lot. Yeah. Because the listen, understand, and validate is listen to someone, no agenda, you're just listening. And you're caring when you're doing that. Understanding is like understanding what they're saying. If you don't, you ask them questions to clarify. And then validate, like, wow, that must have been awesome. Or wow, that must have been really hard. But the love method is how we most care for people as professionals. And it also works best in schools. And it definitely works best in our relationships, just all of us as human beings in relationships. So
mm-hmm. it reminds me of, I was just thinking about this on the drive down here. I have a few clients who, when they're experiencing a lot of stress, they'll come into the session and they'll just unload. And I won't really say much other than, you know, validating and providing some empathy. And at the end of the session, recently this happened, one of my clients said, wow, I feel so much better. I feel really like a weight has been lifted. And, you know, you didn't really do a lot. It's just, I talked about it. I was just like, I know. That's awesome that you were just able to get that out. And really, it's just kind of how you're saying, you don't really need to, you know, be, and we were talking about superheroes in the last episode, be this huge superhero to this person other than provide that care and love and support.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
You were doing, I bet you anything, of course, the love method, even if you didn't call it that.
Yeah.
That's what you were doing. And that's why people feel better after a good session of unloading or talking.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And we also talked a lot in our sort of intro episode about sort of not waiting for things to pile up to access those services or talk to that one person, because it's so much harder to, like Shelby gave the analogy of a cell phone battery, like it's so much harder to get back to 100 from zero than it is to kind of address things when they're at like
100%
or 50%. So.
Right. Right. Yep. Well said.
I wonder, you know, so we're talking about this feeling of stress, but are there places, is there a way that stress sort of manifests itself in the body?
Mm.
So For us, and does it change throughout the life cycle?
That's a good question.
It's such a good question. I actually yesterday listened to students who did a presentation on the mind-body connection and toxic stress and treatment. It was a CBT discussion just yesterday. And it reminded me that in this past year, clinically, I've been really working on that understanding of the physical part of stress. Mm-hmm. And it actually isn't a part. That's what it is. Everything we feel emotionally is a physical feeling. Everything.
Yeah.
We haven't thought about that very much. We don't talk about it very much, but
yeah,
everything, that's what we call it, feelings, because we actually feel them. So if you're feeling a big continuous fear response, which is a natural biological feeling, you're feeling a tightness in your chest and a rush of chemicals and hormones in your body. You're feeling maybe shortness of breath, heart beating. Your palms are sweating. And the reason that happens is to prepare us for fight or flight every single time. Mm-hmm. It's not just a line on the savanna. It's like, I'm going to get a paper back from my professor and I'm really concerned. I'm really worried it's not going to be good. So I start to get this fear response, which is completely physical. We describe it with our minds, but we only feel it with our bodies. And so the short-term effect is that, to prepare us for fight or flight, maybe freeze, but usually typically it's fight or flight, which is, you know, you have to have that emotion to fight back the aggressor, or you have to have that feeling also to run like hell, to fight like hell or run like hell. Mm-hmm. The long-term effect is really, it's nefarious. The long-term effect of stress in our body, which is really mostly related to the cortisol release, but I'm not a physician. I can't get into that. It's way beyond my pay scale, so to speak. But you know, when we prepare to fight like hell or run like hell, all that stuff happens in our body. And when it happens all the time, day after day after day after day, after year after year after year, after, it affects our heart and our lungs and our tissue and our bones and our being immune from disease. It's just everything. Mm-hmm. Toxic stress not changed or treated results typically in a body that has gone through way too much wear and tear, so to speak. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's just nefarious in terms of what it does to our body, which is why we want to know about this and treat it, and why we want to know about it early. Mm-hmm. Because let's say you're a 45-year-old person and life's been basically fine. You know, a lot of good stuff going on. You got stress here and there, but then you get into toxic stress day after day, month after month, and at least a year of constant fear. And then you've got a big AME and you've got generalized anxiety. You know, if you don't treat that, your body is going to start to break down. Mm-hmm. Because of all that. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to start in childhood. It can happen anytime.
Right.
But I do, in terms of childhood, I just got to say that as a school board member, one thing that just kind of freaks me out is how many kids come to kindergarten and they already have a big ME or small HIPAA.
Yeah.
They already do, because we hear stories of kids growing up from birth that are terrifying, terrifying to hear about. And so how do we treat those kids right? I still want to ask, like, child psychiatrists, well, what do we do there? If we can diagnose and we do get permission to treat, how do we treat right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because those kids, A, are not going to learn.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You can't learn when you've got a lion circling you. You're never going to learn.
Right.
And secondly, as soon as someone gives you a sip of alcohol at age 12, and it bathes the fear response, because it literally bathes the human fear response, you're like, oh, I'll do that again.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I've never felt like that in my life. Or worse yet, you know, opioids.
Mm-hmm.
Opioids do two things at once, as far as I know. They totally bathe the fear response. So they suppress fear and they enhance joy.
Yep.
All in one drug. And so I can see why people go in that direction so easily.
Yeah, there's a great model that the Maine Children's Home in Waterville has brought to Maine called trust-based relational interventions. And it addresses that, you know, and so schools, you know, or clinics that are working directly with kids, you know, really focus on that connecting and building those relationships and empowering the kids to use those skills as they're teaching them.
Good. Good.
Then, I mean, correcting behavior plays such a small role in it. But in from what you're saying, it's sounding like, especially, well, in your area, but I would say the same is true here in Central Maine. These kids are younger and younger experiencing some of these really traumatic events or living in some really hellacious settings and coming to school trying to learn. And they're not, we're focusing on feeding their minds when really we need to really focus on developing relationships, mm-hmm. being caring and compassionate.
100%, 100%, because it affects the brain and the body.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And one thing I tell my patients all the time is that life is a symphony. It is never a solo act. Yeah. The brain, the body, the self, the psyche, it's all one going on at once. Yeah. So when you talk about that intervention, absolutely. It's treating the person, the brain, the body, and then that will help with the cognitive mind to learn what they got to learn.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I'm curious, have you seen, you know, in terms of being a school board member and being involved in the school district, have you seen a change between the kindergartners coming in, say this year or last year, and the kids that were starting school in that kindergarten age before COVID?
It's really alarming.
Wow.
And it isn't just the kids coming in for the first time, it's kids returning in a way. Although we never totally shut down, but when you think of living in abuse with constant fear, so a lot of kids get really anxious and behaviorally challenging on Friday because they know they got to go home for the weekend.
Yeah.
And then they come back on Monday and they're kind of a mess for a day or two. Then they get doing a lot better, then it all happens again. Then vacations are awful. So you think about that, then you think about everybody's at home in quarantine.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my God. So behaviorally speaking, and I think you see this in just about every school district, the behavioral challenges going on are off the charts. So the pandemic made it, I think, a whole lot worse for kids than it did for adults. Mm-hmm. I have a lot of people who are, they really weren't affected. I wasn't very much psychologically affected by it, but man, if you're living in an abusive, toxically stressful home, even if like you're a person and your partner is abusive and it's toxic stress every day and you got to be home with that person, same thing will happen.
Yeah.
And on top of just the general uncertainty and fear of like what's going on in the world, like I don't know necessarily that kids had a solid understanding, but just the layers of complexity and trauma, both
yeah.
individually and collectively, it's just so compounding that we're still undoing the damage from it.
Mm-hmm.
Correct. Correct. Absolutely correct. I think it's going to be a long-term project for that. And I'll tell you some other situation that schools see and our schools have seen, and that is what we think is the result of deep neglect.
Mm-hmm.
So deep neglect comes from a baby being born into a home where they don't get like literally any attention and, you know, strapped in a car seat almost 24/7 and being handed a bottle and not changed or and never help. Right. So sometimes once in a while you'll get kids coming into school who, you know, in kindergarten or pre-K, they have no idea how to relate. I think I even heard the story somewhere. I'm not sure if it's in our district or from one else. You know, the kid didn't know his name or their name. And it's just deep neglect is different because of what I think is opioids. So have you ever seen the movie Trainspotting?
No, when I want to. Yeah. I just wanted to say that.
So the most amazing thing about that movie is the baby. And do you want me to be a spoiler or not on the baby?
Do it.
Spoiler alert, everyone.
Do it.
Yeah. Spoiler alert. Okay. So there's a group of four people, I think, in an apartment, and they get the drug and they use it and they pass out and they get the drug and they use it and they pass out. That's all they can do. That's where they're at in their life. And there's a baby, and the baby's crawling around the apartment. No attention to it whatsoever. Like, it is like the way the director did it is the adults are doing their thing and passing out, and the baby's just kind of crawling around. And at first you're like, well, that's kind of amazing. And then one day the woman starts screaming from the other room because she went in and the baby had died in its crib, and it had died of neglect and food and everything. And that was, they didn't really talk about it, but that's the point. That's deep neglect. That is happening all over the world, but it's happening around here too. And so what we see in the kids who come to school is, I mean, forget the cognitive part, forget the have they ever been read to part. It's a lot worse than that. So that's one aspect, and that does not relate to the pandemic. Mm-hmm. That's just a reality of what's going on in some homes for some kids.
Right.
But the pandemic was, first it's fear. It's like, am I going to die? I'm not sure kids of whatever age are thinking that, but anyway, adults are like, am I going to die from this? And then it's isolation. And then, like I said, living in a home of toxic stress, a whole lot more now than you did before.
Right.
Yeah, school was like a sanctuary mm-hmm. for some of them. And then they didn't
yep.
have that. That teacher might yep. have been their trusted adult and someone that they looked forward to seeing. Yep. And they lost
yep.
that.
Yep, yep. Yep. And then we have these community groups like Trekkers and Landing Place and others who could only do virtual. They couldn't get together. And they, you know, they're all about caring relationships. So students were lacking those things too.
Mm-hmm.
I worked for an after school program during that time, and we shifted. I think I talked about this in one of our episodes already, but we shifted to virtual programming, but I would still bring supplies to the kids in person masked and just kind of leave it and wave. And that small yeah. interaction, like I could just see a glimpse into yeah. the version of them that I see at school, but they have to be a completely different person at home. And it's just because of their circumstances. And it was yeah. a really wild experience to witness that and to be let into that little piece of their life that they kept so closed off intentionally.
Right.
Yeah.
That's a powerful thing you just said. And it's so true. And it's so real. I know you, Maisie. You say powerful things a lot. I know you.
Thank you.
She does say powerful things a lot.
I think very deeply all the time. It's quite exhausting.
I know. yeah, right. That's what's tiring.
Quite stressful.
Yeah. I wonder if we might shift the conversation to talk about this idea of healthy stress. In your experience, Lauren, is there such thing as healthy stress?
I'm experiencing it right now.
Okay.
Right? So healthy stress is the kind of fear feeling we need to be focused and sharp.
Okay.
We have a fear feeling to protect ourselves and also to be focused and sharp. And so when I started the interview, and probably my heart rate is up now a little bit, but that's why it exists. That's healthy stress.
Okay.
You know, and anything you do in life that matters something to you, if you have a fear it's not going to go well, you're going to be better at it. Mm. Think of athletes, think of people doing drama, think of anything. You got to feel that to be sharp.
Mm-hmm.
So that the human fear response is completely healthy, completely. And in these smaller ways, we can see like, oh yeah, that's a good thing. And in other ways, it's like, oh, that's a result of toxic stress, or though that's a result of trauma. But all that's supposed to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Biologically vital to happen, just like joy, just like sadness, and just like anger. We need all those emotions to navigate life well. So it's a great question. It's so important that people listening know that you want to feel a certain amount of stress, which you might use the word of like worry or concern or nervous to describe it. It's not toxic at all. I mean, it's not going to change anything about your body. It's just going to focus you.
Yeah.
You want that.
Yeah. I don't know about in your clinical experience. It sounds like it's very similar, but I know with clients that I've worked with, I often describe that type of stress really as the grit. Like if you're on some, if you're trying to get your car unstuck from
the that's good.
A little bit.
That's good.
Under something like that to move you forward.
Yep.
Yeah.
That's a good one.
Very good.
Yep. Yeah. Sometimes I wonder too, if some people feel like they shouldn't have any sort of stress. Yep. Like that means that, or any sort of stress feels like it's a negative thing, mm-hmm. when really that's a completely healthy and like quote unquote normal thing to have some amount of stress.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Gotta have it. Gotta feel it. It's like, we gotta feel sadness when we lose somebody or something. Gotta feel it. Otherwise we're not going to know what real joy is. And also I think actually sadness is a sudden lack or chronic lack of joy, but we got to feel that thing. We got to feel anger because we have to fight against something that is attacking us. We have to do something, because if we sit there and just take it, we're not going to do well or even survive on the savannah or whatever you want to call it.
Yep.
Every emotional response is healthy and essential. Mm-hmm. It's how we know that and how we manage it. So when I work with patients, you can call it emotional intelligence if you want to or whatever, but it's like, knowing primary emotions, knowing you're supposed to feel the way you feel, that's why you do, you're never doomed, you're looking for change, knowing to pursue joy, purpose and connection through joy, you know, gets you a lot of joy, gets you the most joy. So all of that, I think, is really great CBT or cognitive behavioral therapy or change for people who are like, I'm not doing well. Okay, let's talk about why, let's listen, understand, validate, let's talk about change, which is understanding how emotions work, how they're supposed to work. And you and I, by the way, we're the same. Mm-hmm. I love telling that to patients because they're like, oh, wait a minute, you're a therapist. You know, oh, yeah, you.
Yeah.
We're all the same.
Yeah.
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 Anyone can experience toxic stress for the reasons we talk about. Anyone mm-hmm. can experience PTSD because we're supposed to.
Mm-hmm.
And you're never doomed. You're never doomed. That can change.
Like yeah. that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What are some of these tried and true ways that you found that help to manage stress or address stress, those sorts of things?
So I'm trying to think, Maisie, did we talk about situational anxiety versus generalized anxiety when you were took the class?
I think so. Don't ask me to talk about it though.
Right. Because there are things that I've developed over the years of teaching this class, but that distinction is really, really vital. So again, generalized anxiety is a big Amy. And what I strongly feel, because the research tells this, and every patient of mine tells me this, is that when you take a serotonin medication, it shrinks the amygdala. It just does. I've never seen it not work, ever. So if I diagnose someone with generalized anxiety, which is a very clear presentation to me by now, I recommend that. And then I recommend change, whatever change you feel needs to be made. You want to eliminate toxic stress if you can. You want to change your perspective, which is a cognitive shift into what emotions are all about and why. And you want to get into change, especially I talk a lot about purpose and connection, or loving what you do and loving the people you're with. That's how I focus my treatment is on that. But the thing that I think that from the research and a lot of it and now experiences mindfulness-based stress reduction. So situational anxiety is feeling really anxious about like public speaking or test taking or anything. Like, otherwise I'm fine. I don't have that anxiety going on, but these situations I do. And so I don't think medication is vital for that. Do it if you want. And I tell people, I'm not your doctor. You choose that with your doctor, but I don't think that's going to make the difference. What I think is managing your stress in the moment. And mindfulness teaches people really well how to manage the fear response, stress response, same thing, really well in the moment. If from that, I take deep belly breathing and try to teach that to my patients, because again, the science and the experience tells us that the long exhale from a belly breath calms the nervous system, and that is an man, when you can do that and you're like, oh my God, it works. That's a great thing as well.
That's funny. We were just talking in the last episode about how we feel physically when we're stressed. And I mentioned that I literally forget to breathe. Like one time I was in my office at work and I was writing a stressful email or doing something, and I finally exhaled, and my coworker was at her desk, like a door away, and she pokes her head in and goes, "Were you not breathing that whole time?" And I was like, "I don't think I was."
Yeah.
And so like even just taking that moment to like remember how to breathe is such a game changer. It's wild.
Game changer. Right. Yeah. Because when we have a fear response, the body's trying to get energy to the muscles. Mm-hmm. And so it changes our breathing, it changes our heart rate, it changes other things. And anyway, we get that shallow breathing. So when you're mindful and go, okay, I'm just going to step back and just do a couple breathing, just a few, it changes your neurology. It changes your physical experience. It is, as you said, game changer. It is absolutely real and works. Yeah.
I think I did a project in, it might've been your class, in somebody's class about mindfulness-based stress reduction. It was fascinating. I also used to do that with my students too. We would incorporate a mindfulness piece into our after school program to try to teach them some of those tools and those coping mechanisms. So when they did feel that situational anxiety, they had, you know, they were able to recognize the feeling in their body and then implement those belly breaths, or, you know, the grounding strategy of seeing five things, two things you smell, something like that. Just really bringing them back to the moment.
Nice.
Yep. So a guy named Dan, I forget his last name, but Dan is a newscaster on Channel 6 in Portland. And I think from there, he went to some national broadcast, but he had a panic attack on camera. And I can talk about panic attacks in a second, but after that, he got treatment. And mindfulness is a big part of it. And he wrote a book about that. And he's a TED Talk about that. You know, forget his last name. But anyway, he's a great example.
Oh, Dan Harris.
There we go.
He has a whole app and podcast and stuff now, too.
Yes, 10% happier. Yeah, you had told me about him. I love that podcast.
There we go.
Yeah.
There we go.
It's very cool.
So a panic attack, and I tell people this all the time as well, is fear of fear. So when we have this huge physical experience of fear, at some point we may notice it and think, am I dying? And then there's the fear of the fear feelings that happen. That's called a panic attack, where you feel attacked, like you're going to be dying. You are dying. And if we could teach this to everybody, like if you ever feel this way, this is what it is. Don't be concerned. You're having a big fear response, literally to a big fear response. Mm-hmm. You're not going to die. You're not going to go crazy. You're not going to blow up. All these things that, especially if you have more and more of them, you start thinking, I will go crazy. I will die. You know, this all is just like a panic attack is such a remarkably understandable event that only humans have. Mm-hmm. Other animals don't have panic attacks because they can't reflect on their feelings. They can't say, I am feeling something. And it's a longer topic, but it's helpful for patients to hear that. And I think it's absolutely fascinating as a clinician is that we're the only animal that has a panic attack. Every other animal with a brain like ours is going to have a fear response, but none of them can think about it and think, what's wrong with me? Because they don't have reflective awareness.
Yeah, it's really powerful.
It's fascinating. Yeah, definitely.
And now the Center for Anxiety and Related Disorders at Boston University is where I learned all of that. I think they are amazing. They kick ass. They just do. They got it going on. And so if you ever want to look that up, the Unified Protocol is, I think, some of the most powerful psychological understanding based on decades of research and great psychology. It's very similar to what I talk about in terms of primary emotions and understanding that, understanding why fear response exists, toxic stress, et cetera. They nailed it. So everyone looked that up. They are amazing. But they really nailed the idea of, like, you know, panic and anxiety. They just totally got it. And they have great programs. They have manuals. You know, I've referred people to go there. And they have like a week long for panic attack and anxiety, which is a great way to approach that particular challenge in life. So anyway.
Very cool.
So if you were to give advice to, we're recording this kind of right before the holiday season, finals might be happening, people might be going home to be with their family for the holidays. Like, it's kind of a time of high stress for a lot of people for a lot of reasons. What advice would you give, like, a typical stressed out college kid?
Well, lots of love. I'll always say that, caring relationships. Get yourself on YouTube and learn how to breathe mindfully. And focus on your learning. Like I tell all my classes, it's all about what you learn. Your grade doesn't matter. It just doesn't. I mean, sometimes you want to go to grad school. Okay, fine. But most of us, it just doesn't matter. Yeah. No. I mean, like, bother. But I mean, like, it's like when people freak out about their grades, like they got to get A's and everything. They got to be that sort of perfection ideal. That's been drilled into people's heads, especially adolescents, for the last decade. And FOMU makes it worse. But so again, it's mostly about caring relationships. It's about utilizing breathing techniques. You got like 3 weeks left. Just get on YouTube and try to learn how to breathe well when you need to. And then just dive in deep for learning's sake. Just, you know, like I literally, do you remember my video updates, Maisie?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So in the update to undergrads a week or so ago, I literally said that every time about focus on your learning, but I said, you know, if you're stressed, you let me know. If I can help you in this class, you let me know. But most importantly, you keep digging yourself deeply into your work, and you keep doing what you do. And certainly in my class, you're going to get a great grade. But the point is, that is the point, is learning.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd say those three things as advice.
Awesome.
Because if you ignore your relationships and you don't work on them and make them mutually caring is the key, then that stress is going to be so much more difficult.
Yeah,
awesome. Do you guys have any final questions or final thoughts that we'd like to share? I think we're just about wrapped up for this episode.
This has been really great. I felt like I was maybe attending one of your classes. I have so many notes written down. It was awesome, though. Really helpful and insightful.
Yeah. I do have a small YouTube channel where I do talk about stuff like this on it as well. But if you guys take this this knowledge of how our emotions work and the difference between toxic stress and PTSD and how to treat them, and you help your clients, you're going to see great change for them. Because to me, what's important is being biologically accurate and psychologically healthy.
Mm-hmm.
Those two things go together. We really understand what's going on for us. We can help ourselves and help definitely our clients and patients to be like, oh yeah, that really makes sense. In fact, you know, like people with bipolar disorder can understand their emotions better by understanding all this stuff.
Yeah.
And primary emotions. It just goes really far. So I hope it's helpful to you. I hope it's helpful to anybody listening. Because, again, you've heard me say it several times. One of the main messages, if you're feeling really badly and really anxious, depressed, you're not doomed. That can be changed.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you so much for your time and your wisdom and insight. I wanted you to speak on this because the class I took with you was so memorable and so impactful. And I just wanted you to share your wealth of knowledge with the community. So I really, really appreciate your time. And I'll give my little spiel. As always, you can find us on the UMA website, on Podbean. We're working to get on Google, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, the big guys. But you know, if you have any other questions or topics you want us to make sure that we cover, please do reach out and let us know. We want to be here for you. And you have your wonderful clinicians on campus too, who are thrilled to be supporting you in stressful times and working through some of those big feelings. So again, thank you so much, Lauren. It was such a pleasure hearing from you.
Thank you. Very honored to be here. Thank you so much.
Thank you.